Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And as we continue to learn, I mean, folks, if you think I'm not learning here, I am. As a matter of fact, what we've been covering since the Utah Enabling Acts has been a bunch of discovery for me. So I'm hoping that you continue to discover things you never learned. And that goes hand in hand with the appeal to heaven to learn, pray, and act on these things that we keep learning. I am absolutely amazed at how early it was. I'm amazed that the federal government decided to actually act well outside the boundaries in justifying to the states how they were going to pay down some things or how they were going to create streams of revenue when they didn't have the authority to do that. The states should have created the streams of revenue for themselves so that they could have paid the federal government based on what it expended in the needs of fulfilling their constitutional roles and responsibilities, period. But we're going to go through this and we're going to really see how the coercion, I'll use coercion, but I don't think it was really coercive. I think that they created a, let's call it a symbiotic relationship, a mutually benefiting relationship between their debt issues, possibly, and the advantages that they could create for the states. Because that's what we're reading in the Preemptive Act of 1841. And we're going to continue doing that. But let me dive into two more things. Had the people listened, and instead of having Madison be the one to demand compliance of the Constitution, had the people actually been the push in demanding that their public servants comply to the Constitution, which would require the people to understand that. Bottom line, an age of ignorance brings on an age of tyranny. That is something that the framers have taught us. History has taught us that ignorance is no excuse, because if it is, then the law is ignorance of the law. Then if we're ignorant, the law can be pretended, and they're pretending the crap out of the law today. So much so that people are literally executing and behaving in ways, conservative ways, that people think are legitimate. This is how far off we are. Anyway, so we need to demand compliance. That is the whole focus. We don't want to cherry pick. Anybody that comes to you and wants you to cherry pick on one issue, you know, support, or as a matter of fact, it was I'm not surprised. All of these people are scoundrels. Anybody that is running a myopic agenda in today's world where the problem is far more than just one little myopic agenda, these people are coming out. The owners of the Gun Owners Association of America, or whatever, this group that goes around, you know, demanding that everything supports the Second Amendment rights, they've been caught. So I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised that groups are going to get caught with their hands serving themselves, or, you know, these insinuating or these exposing pictures of these people basically on the take. I'm not surprised. So politics makes interesting bedfellows, bottom line. Now, we also are seeking an opportunity to wake up America regarding the public election in 2028 for president. It shouldn't be a public election. It should not be a popular vote. We need to help everybody understand what the Electoral College is, because most people have this affinity for it, but they don't realize that the parties have taken full control over it, and they're not functioning it the way it's supposed to function. We, the people, are to choose our electors, and people are to run as electors on the candidacy bill. And so that means that you would have lots of electors, a lot. For each district, there would be, you know, 5, 4, 6, however many real candidates that get the support across the nation, and people actually selecting, this is the right guy to do. And then going and listening to the details and so forth, and then voting for that elector, then they will choose, as they've committed to choosing, the proper president. And then they will choose the vice president instead of worrying about what the nominee has decided to pick for their running partner, so that they can have this level of control or collusion. You do have to realize that if you create a dichotomy, if you create a situation where these two, you know, president and vice president actually complement each other, but they don't necessarily see eye to eye, that's a good thing. That's a very good thing. So anyway, let me dive into, without any further ado, the Preemptive Act of 1871, the grant of land for purposes of internal improvements. So in other words, they're granting this land. We've already gotten through Section 6 already, or actually Section 5. We're going into Section 6. So we've already exposed a couple of acts, and as I've read ahead a little bit, I've only read ahead for maybe up to Section 11, and there's already other acts that I've uncovered that actually, and this goes, it even goes back to the 1820s of the land grants and so forth. I'm not surprised that this one bill names lots of nefarious bills that were created, and this kind of lends to how things really started going sideways in 1820. How Monroe may have been, you know, a guy with good intent and a good heart, maybe, I don't know. But things literally started going sideways on his watch. And keep in mind, in his re-election bid of 1820, right, because he was re-elected in 1820, right? Yeah, it was a zero because he was elected in 1816, took office in 1817, 18, 19, 20. So in his fourth year, he was re-elected, and he was re-elected unanimously, except for one elector chose not to cast his vote because he didn't want Monroe to have the unanimous vote, to have a unanimity in the Electoral College. That only happened once with George Washington. Ergo, it didn't happen minus one vote. So it was a token holdback, but it was huge. And it was huge, folks, because this is what the Republicans had done in basically moving everybody's heart and minds to believing in the Republican Party. And it goes to show how everybody by this point in time didn't really care too much. They were just so enamored by government. This is where Monroe started going wrong with the Missouri Compromise, these land acts, and so forth. So even though Monroe did some things that were right, this is when things started going wrong. And so Section 6, and be it further enacted, here's the key here, that there shall be annually appropriated for completing the surveys of said lands a sum not less than $150,000 at the minimum price at which the public lands are now sold at private sale, not to be increased unless Congress shall think proper to grant alternate sections along the line of any canal or internal improvement, and at the same time to increase the minimum price of the sections reserved, and in case the same shall be increased by law, except as aforesaid, at any time during the operation of this act, then so much of this act provides that the net proceeds, the net, in other words, the profit that they make of the sales of the public land, shall be distributed among the several states, but they don't tell them how much that they're really getting. Shall from and after the increase of the minimum price thereof cease and become utterly null and of no effect, anything in this act to the contrary notwithstanding, provided that if at any time during the existence of this act there shall be an imposition of duties on imposts inconsistent with the provisions of the act of March 2nd, 1838. Now, what I just gave you was a new act that exposes another thing that they were doing regarding the land sales, this Ponzi scheme that they started creating, where the government, and some of the things that actually flabbergast me, because the Secretary of Treasury was driving all of this, because this became the new mechanism of taxation, the favorable form of obtaining money. Why? Because now the states weren't having to pay. The states were participating in taking land from other states so that they could actually get the government to create things that they had no power to do. Highways, waterways, improvements, and so forth. Things that they didn't have the authority to do. Entitled an act, so this is the actual act entitled, an act to modify the act of the 14th of July, 1832. Okay, so what this just did was this actually identified another act of the 14th of July, 1832. So in this one section, it identifies that there was an act that changed the outcome or the manipulations of land, public land sales, and how to divvy it up and everything else. This new act changed a previous act. So they're basically in Section 6 saying that at any time during the existence of this act, which is the preemptive act, there shall be an imposition on duties or imports inconsistent with the provision of the act of March. In other words, if it's not consistent with this previous act of 1833, then that would go back to the 1833. Then it would go back to July 1, 1832. So they're creating acts, referencing acts to acts to acts. I know most people, when you start going down the rat hole and you start finding these things, this right here becomes an indictment of manipulation and gaming. So anyway, and all other acts imposing duties on imposts or imports, and beyond the rate of duty fixed by that act, to wit, 20% on the value of such imports or any of them, then distribution provided in this act shall be suspended, and shall continue until the cause of suspension shall be removed. And when removed, it, if not prevented by other provisions of this act, such distribution shall be resumed. Okay, so Section 7. This is a very convoluted way of getting the states on board to surrendering land of new states and their own states, because they've kind of already, kind of, that was what they anteed in into this game. And so Section 7, and be it further enacted that the Secretary of the Treasury may continue any land district in which is situated the seat of government of any one of the states, and may continue the land office in such district, notwithstanding the quantity of land unsold in such district, may not amount to 100,000 acres. When, in his opinion, such continuance may be required by public convenience or in order to close the land system in such state as convenient at a convenient point under the provision of the act on the subject approved 12th June 1840. So now they point to another act that they are using for the ending of the sales of lands or what have you. So you can't help but look at, you know, how convoluted this is. And so guess who's going and buying, getting all these acts? I'm downloading all of these. As a matter of fact, there's so much happening that in my mind, it's very confusing. One of the things I've learned and in digging through all of this is that this goes all the way back to 1820 with the initial selling of public land. The concept, public, quote unquote, that's the first time I've seen this. Now, I believe that it probably existed beforehand, public land, quote unquote. Not sure if this goes back to that charter. I don't think it goes back to the second charter of the bank, but I think somewhere after, you know, between the War of 1812 and to 1820, because that's the act I'm talking about, there was a reference or an establishment of creating public land to be sold so that the United States could have a new form of revenue. Now, remember that the way they were to be funding for the general welfare of the Union was through those direct taxes, right? Taxes apportioned to the states, imposts, and excise taxes. That was it. Okay, so Section 8. And be it further enacted that there shall be granted to each state specified in the first section of this act 500,000 acres of land for purpose of internal improvement. Now, 500,000 acres of land. In other words, these states are giving up 500,000 acres so that this would fund their internal improvements. Wow. Okay, so provided that to each of the said states, which has already received grants for said purposes, there is hereby granted no more than a quantity of land which shall, together with the amount of such state has already received as foresaid, make 500,000 acres. So, in other words, if they've already had a grant, in other words, they're only going to cap them out at 500,000. So, if the state has already had 400,000, then they're only going to be able to add 100,000, capping them at a half a million. The selection of the said states to be made within the limits respectively in such manner as the legislature thereof shall direct. So in other words, each state legislature directed where those lands would be and located in parcels comfortably to sectional divisions and subdivisions, if not less than 320 acres in any one location or any public land except such as or may be reserved from sale by any law of Congress or proclamation of the President of the United States, which said locations may be made at any time after the lands of the United States and said states respectively shall have been surveyed according to existing laws. And that there shall be hereby, and there shall be, and hereby is granted to each new states joining the Union, right? So, and there shall be, and hereby is granted to each new state that shall be hereafter admitted into the Union upon such admission, so much land as including such quantity as may be granted to such state after its admission and while under the territorial government for purposes of internal improvement, as aforesaid, and shall make 500,000 or 500,000 acres to be selected and located as aforesaid. This clearly is a violation of the terms of admitting new states into the Union, that once a state became a state, it was not to be subjugated in any way to the federal government. Ah, but they're going to make these improvements, and you're going to want to get along with this because this is a great scheme. You know, they're going to connect everybody. Actually, the connection of states to states, that burden really had been left to the states, that the states needed to do this. And so the states just couldn't do this on their own. At least they were convinced that they couldn't do this on their own. So where did the money come from for building, other than obviously they were making projects, waterway projects and land projects and so forth? I believe a part of this whole proposition, because I've yet to uncover, because at the same time, the railroads were building and growing in America. Where was that money and who was getting paid for them to get the land and to actually start operating railroads throughout the United States? Folks, what had really happened in the early 1800s is the federal government shifted a way for the selling of America so that they could fund and improve and benefit from this improvement of the flowing of commerce. Because the more commerce flowed in America, the more revenue the federal government would make. In other words, they created themselves into this corporate management of states. They didn't have that role. They never had these responsibilities. And so, moving into Section 9, and be it further enacted that the lands herein granted to the states above mentioned shall not be disposed of at a price less than $1.25 per acre. Wow. $1.25 per acre. Now, I don't know, but if you have 500,000 acres, a 500,000 acres, then that would make what? Okay, so let me just do the bare math. I'm just thinking here, 1.25 times a 500,000, and that would come to $625,000. Now, if you look at the states that they're doing it in, if I remember correctly, something like 7 or 8, then that means multiple millions of dollars that are coming in that they're starting to divvy up among the states. Now, back in those days, I mean, just look at the cost of an acre. $1.25? I think anybody listening to this right now would wish that they could go buy land at $1.25 an acre. The fact is that the states shouldn't actually be allowing the federal government to do this. I mean, the state should actually have it upon themselves to be able to do this. They think that they're benefiting by the federal government doing these things, and really they're not. So anyway, back to this. For less than $1.25 per acre until otherwise authorized by law of the United States, and the net proceeds of the sale of said lands shall be faithfully applied to objects of internal improvements within the states aforesaid, respectively, namely, and this is what they were going to build, roads, railways, so they were doing railways, bridges, canals, and improvement of water courses, and draining of swamps, and such roads, railways, canals, bridges, and water courses, when made or improved, shall be free for the transportation of the United States mail and munitions of war, and for the passage of their troops without the payment of any toll whatever. Now, when I come back, I'm going to show you how antithetical that is and how everything had literally been turned upside down by the federal government, where they weren't paying for anything. We will be right back after this promo. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so when we go into the Constitution, remember, the federal government can't have any land within a state. They're not to possess land, because the minute that they can possess any kind of land that they want, that's when the mischief comes in. And it's the same thing with the ability to enforce any of their laws. That's when mischief comes in, because now they have a standing army. This is why we go through the ratification debates, okay, folks? However, in Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 16, Congress shall have the power to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district not exceeding 10 miles square. In other words, it can't be greater than that. It doesn't have to be that big, but it can't be greater than that. As may by session of particular states, and the acceptance of Congress become the seat of government of the United States, and to exercise like authority over places, over real estate, purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state in which the same shall be, for the erection of forts, magazines, dockyards, and other needful buildings. That's it. So for them to be doing these land improvements for highways, waterways, that has to be amended to the Constitution. And because they're getting away with not doing that, they're actually saying, we're going to let you build all of these things, and then we're going to be able to use it for free. The federal government was supposed to actually function as a mechanism of working, and then the states paying for what they had to do. Not to be able to have land, to become rich, and to become tyrannical in controlling everything. They were limited and defined, and this is why they had to pay. And when they had to a new fort, or they in a new state joined the Union, they needed to buy up the land for them to possess those forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and needful buildings. The money that they spent in buying those pieces of real estate went into their budget, and that was distributed amongst all of the states. That the taxation would literally be basically contained into duties, which are direct tax. Duties are the taxes of apportionment. Today, the 16th Amendment changed that to income tax. So the duties are income tax today, impost and excise tax, which shall be uniform throughout the United States. So the uniformity clause still applies to direct taxes, the duty tax or the income tax. We're all to have it uniform. In other words, I'm not supposed to be paying any more than you pay. And the rich guy isn't supposed to be paying any more than the poor guy. Because when they allow them to play these manipulations, they'll always victimize the poor people. Oh, they're victims, and we got to take more from the rich. They have no business playing those types of games. None. Not at all.
Ah, but they are the epitome of playing games and manipulating people. And this is why when we look at everything that's happening, we think this is all good. This is good, right? It's good. Doge is good. No, it's not. They're maintaining powers, roles, responsibilities, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Properties, right? Standards, all of these things that they're doing that they've done unconstitutionally need to be dismantled and basically decommissioned and scuttled, gotten rid of, period. So, as we move back into this preemptive act, we've talked about these highways, waterways, that they couldn't do this. They actually had to pay for these things if they were to use them for the passage of their troops without payment or of any toll whatsoever. And so, as we highlight these things, it just, to me, these things kind of jump out. Okay, now, Section 10. And be it further enacted that from the passage of this act, every person being the head of a household, of a head of a family, or widow, or single man, over the age of 21 years, and it doesn't say, you know, it can't be a woman, so they're basically opening this up to men and women, and being a citizen of the United States, or shall have filed their declaration, it says his declaration of intention to become a citizen, as required by the naturalization laws, who since the first day of June, A.D. 1840, okay, so that's the first day of 18 June. I have to highlight these things because this is actually something that has happened. And actually, we need to undo that. So as you look, I try to use these color codes so that we can differentiate between one thing and the other. Okay, after the first day of June, A.D. 1840, has made or shall hereafter make a settlement in person on the public lands to which the Indian title has been at the time of such settlement extinguished, and which has been or shall have been surveyed prior hereto, and who shall inhabit and improve the same, and who shall erect a dwelling thereon, shall be and is hereby authorized to enter with the register of the land office for the district in which such land may lie by legal subdivisions, my number of acres not exceeding 160 or a quarter section of land, to include the residence of such claimant upon paying the United States the minimum price, such land subject, however, the following limitations and exceptions. No person shall be entitled to more than one preemptive right by virtue of this act. Okay, so the preemptive right is obviously this 160 acres. In other words, you can't be entitled to more than just one. Where some people were probably scamming and saying, okay, we're going to do this. No person shall be entitled to more than one preemptive right by virtue of this act. No person who is the proprietor of 320 acres of land in any state or territory of the United States, and no person who shall quit or abandon his residence on his own land to reside on the public land in the same state or territory, shall acquire any right of preemption under this act. So there you go. And so as we kind of go through this, then what they're basically doing is they're saying, hey, we're going to allow everybody to, you know, be able to make these types of claims. This is just huge, folks, if you understand what they're talking about. And so at this point in time, you would think that this would actually open the floodgates of immigration for people to come to these lands, as long as they have that kind of money to be able to get that land, right? So hundreds of dollars. They'd have to have hundreds of dollars. no lands included in any reservation by any treaty, law, or proclamation of the President of the United States or reserved for sailings, in other words, for salt, or for other purposes, no lands reserved for the support of schools nor the lands acquired by either the last two treaties with the Miami tribe in the state of Indiana or which may be acquired of the Wyandot tribe of Indians in the state of Ohio or other Indian reservations to which the title has been or may be extinguished by the United States, and at any time during the operation of this act, no sections of land reserved to the United States alternate to other sections granted to the states for the construction of any canal, road, or other public improvement. No sections or fractions of sections included within the limits of the incorporated town. No portions of public lands which have been selected as the site for a city or town. No parcel or land, nor lot of land, actually settled and occupied for the purposes of trade and not agriculture. And no lands on which are situated any known salines or mines shall be liable to entry under the virtue of the provision of this act. Okay, so now they're basically creating all of these different qualifications so that we actually kind of have this set aside. You can't do these things. You can't have this land if it's going to be used for these purposes or you've had other land or what have you. And so much of the proviso of the Act of 22nd of June, 1838, which is a new act, which I have to highlight now so that we now have another act to go get, or any order of the said of the President of the United States as direct certain reservations to be made in favor of certain claims under the Treaty of Dancing Rabbit Creek be, and the same is hereby repealed, provided that such repeal shall not affect any title to any tract of land secured in virtue of said treaty. Are you following this? So you see how this has gotten so convoluted that they've created these things. Then they have these independent hands creating treaties with Indians, and then they have to make sure that this act doesn't deal with that. And, oh, this new any new acts and build upon acts and so forth that actually kind of brush along, violate, or could potentially cause problems, they have to put all these provisions in it. One would think that this is, you know, just mayhem. They are being very methodical in controlling the management, the growth, every aspect of the states at this point in time. And boy, I'll bet you anything, they wish they lived in the age of computers in these days, because their life would be so much easier, like it is today, where they can just, you know, click a, you know, and basically a point or a reference of land and all get all the information of how they control that land and all the precedents, or I should say, you know, the what do you call that, the ancestry of acts and acquire the acquisitions, all those types of things. Anyway, okay, so the Section 11, and be it further enacted that when two or more persons shall have settled on the same quarter section of land, the right of preemption shall be in him or her who made the first settlement, provided such persons shall conform to the other provisions of this act. And all questions as to the right of preemption, arising between different settlers, shall be settled by the register and the receiver of the district within such land is situated, subject to an appeal and a revision by the Secretary of the Treasury of the United States. So the Secretary of the Treasury, will then be involved in land disputes. Now, I remember a ways back when we started going through this in the Enabling Act of Utah, the Secretary of the Interior had all these controls. Well, where's the Secretary of Interior? Oh, they hadn't created him yet. The Secretary of Interior basically is going to take over these functions of the Secretary of Treasury and actually these departments that are being created, like the Department of Interior, is becoming a sub-department of the Treasury because it's all feeding money into Uncle Sam. Okay, so Section 12. And be it further enacted that prior to any entries being made under and by the virtue of the provisions of this act, proof of the settlement and improvement thereby required shall be made to the satisfaction of the register and receiver of the land district in which such lands may lie, agreeably to such rules as prescribed by the Secretary of the Treasury, who shall each be entitled to 50 cents from each applicant of his service to be rendered and aforesaid, and all assignments and transfers of the rights hereby secured prior to the issuing of the patent shall be null and void. So the Secretary of Treasury is charging 50 cents for each application. Whether your application was accepted or not, he's still getting 50 cents. Okay, well, that doesn't seem like a lot of money, but when you're talking about thousands of people, that becomes, you know, thousands of dollars. Section 13. And be it further enacted that before any person claiming the benefit of this act shall be allowed to enter such lands, he or she shall make no oath before the receiver or register of the land district in which the land is situated, and in parentheses, who are hereby authorized to administer the same, close parentheses, that he or she has never had the benefit of any right of preemption under this act, that he or she is not the owner of the 320 acres of land in any state or territory of the United States, nor hath he or she settled upon and improved said land to sell the same on speculation, but in good faith to appropriate it to his or her own exclusive use or benefit, and that he or she has not directly or indirectly made any agreements or contracts in any way or manner with any persons or persons whatsoever by which the title which he or she might acquire from the government of the United States should ensure in whole or in part the benefit of any person except himself or herself. And if any person taking such oath shall swear falsely in the premises, he or she shall be subject to all the pains and penalties of perjury and shall forfeit the money which he or she shall have been paid for said land and all right and title to the same and any grant or conveyance which he or she may have made except the hands of bona fide purchasers for a valuable consideration shall be null and void. And it shall be the duty of the officer administering such oath to file certification thereof in the public land of such district and to transmit a duplicate copy to the general land office, either of which shall be good and sufficient evidence that such oath was administered according to the law. Wow, okay, so they're basically making sure that you're not gaming them in something they have, that they're gaming the citizens of. You understand what I just said? The federal government is doing something that they don't have the power to do. They've basically got the states to go along with this scheme of stealing from Peter to pay Paul so that everybody can take, you know, their stipend out of the selling of what Paul had. And therefore, everybody's making money on it, and then they want to make sure that the people aren't scamming them so that they can benefit for themselves in any way. beyond the basic benefit that they will allow, something that they don't have the authority to allow. Are you following me? Okay. So Section 14, and it be further enacted, this act shall not delay the sale of any of the public lands of the United States beyond the time which has been or which may be appointed by the proclamation of the president, nor shall the provision of this act be available to any person or persons who shall fail to make the proof and payment and file the affidavit required before the day appointed for the commencement of the sale of the sale as aforesaid. Section 15. And be it further enacted that whenever any person has settled and or shall settle and improve a tract of land, subject to the time of settlement or private entry, and shall intend to purchase the same under the provisions of this act, such persons shall, in the first case, within 3 months after the passage of the same, and in the last within 30 days next after the next of such settlement, file with the registry of the proper district a written statement describing the land settled upon and declaring the intention of such persons to claim the same under the provision of this act, and shall, where such settlement is already made within 12 months after the passage of this act, and where it shall be made and where it shall hereafter be made within the same period of the date of such settlement, make the poor affidavit and the payment herein required, and if he or she shall fail to file such written statement as aforesaid, or shall fail to make such affidavit, proof, and payment within the 12 months aforesaid, the tract of land so settled and improved shall be subject to the entry of any other purchaser. In other words, if you don't cross your T's, if you don't dot your I's, because you need to be a diligent processor, you need to diligently follow this very specific process, and if you don't, within 12 months, somebody else can come in and take it from you, regardless of what you've done, because you have to follow the process. Section 6. And it shall be further enacted that the 2%, of the proceeds of the sold lands or that may hereafter be sold by the United States in the state of Mississippi since the first day of December 1870 and by this act, an act to enable people for the western part of Mississippi. Now, hold on here. This days does not make sense. 1817. I'm sorry, not 70. Because in my head, that is a day of this act that hasn't even transpired. So this is going back to another act. And GR has to basically identify this act for the admission on equal footing of the said state. Okay, so hold on here. Okay, an act to enable the people of the western part of the Mississippi Territory to form a constitution and state government and for the admission of the state into the Union on equal footing. So hold on here. Let me go before this. And it be further enacted that 2% of the net proceeds of land sold or that here may after be sold by the United States in the state of Mississippi since the first day of December 1817 and be acted entitled. Okay, so let me do this. Because I need to look this up, folks, because when did Mississippi become a state? The statehood order for Mississippi is 1817. So Mississippi became a state after Indiana. And remember, I told you it was Indiana, 1816, was the first state where the federal government started withholding land and creating this notion. I don't think in 1816, and I'm going to pull it up real quick because I'm talking. I know where these things are. So the Enabling Act of Indiana is down here. Okay, so for the Enabling Act, do they use the term public land? So let me do Control F, P-U-B-L-I-C, and is public land. Republican, making public roads and canals prior to the public sale of lands, and the surveyor of public lands is down in Missouri, 1816. Okay, so they're referencing an act of the surveyor of the public lands in the territories of Illinois and Missouri. Now, you got to remember that the territories, those states did not become states. Illinois and Missouri did not become states until when? Well, we know Missouri came in 1821, right? That's when it became a state. And Illinois became a state in 1818. So apparently the concept of creating public lands and at least earmarking them in 1818 and then in 1820 or 21 for Missouri, that all started as they were going. So this is when they started surveying to do these things. So it all literally stems back to 1816. The concept of creating public lands and withholding land within all of these states, because they were just massive territories. I mean, look at how much land there was. And they said, hey, we have an opportunity here. We can make money and reduce the apportionment taxes and game the system instead of following the Constitution. So, all right, let me get back to what I was reading in this said act. And all acts supplemental thereto reserved for the making of roads or roads leading to the state be and the same hereby relinquished to the state of Mississippi, payable to two equal installments, the first to be paid on the 1st of May 1842, and the other on the 1st of May 1843, so far as the same may be then have accrued, and quarterly as the same may accrue after the said period, provided that the legislature of the said state shall first pass an act declaring their acceptance of said relinquishment in full and of said fund. So in other words, I don't have enough time, but in other words, what they're saying is that they're going to pay you, but you first have to acknowledge, or you have to basically state that what you're doing, you're willingly doing. In other words, they're making them complicit in what we would call the corruption of the selling of America to make life in the states better, because they came up with what they felt was a better system than what the Constitution provided in allowing the states to actually do what they needed to do. Bottom line, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.